What's up, everybody? My name is Lee. Some of you guys might know me as Intuition, and you're tuned into Kinda Neat. Thank you guys again for tuning in. We appreciate it as always. Make sure that you go right now on your iPhone and download the iPod app and subscribe to Kinda Neat on there. If you're streaming on the internet, you're making your life so much harder than it needs to be. Just download that app. There's an app for that. You know, we appreciate you guys tuning in. All the reviews, the 5-star ratings, the comments on the iTunes, it helps so much. Thank you guys so much for doing that. While you're at it, you can subscribe to us on social media stuff. You can follow me at It's Intuition. You can follow my man behind the boards, Ben Shim, making the shit sound buttery, at I Am Database, base with two S's. You can follow us as a unit at That's Kinda Neat, Facebook.com/KindaNeat, and YouTube.com/That's Kinda Neat. Everything wrapped up in a pretty package on kindaneat.net. Now that we've got that out of the way, this week we have in my dude Jeff Weiss, very prolific writer, well-respected and well-known music journalist who is, you know, starting to convert into some sports journalism. He's writing about the Lakers currently and stuff like that. But we get into talk about growing up in LA in the slums of Beverly Hills and, you know, his journey into being a pretty early blogger and choosing to go the route of writing, you know, what I would consider like miniature think pieces on songs rather than just posting up press releases and stuff like that, and how it's kind of led him to other things. Great conversation. I had a good time. He also has a podcast with one of my good friends, No Can Do, called Shots Fired. So you guys can check him out doing that. First things first, got some questions. I got some questions from you guys. You guys have questions for me, and I've got advice, and we'll see how I do. I had a couple of these about this specific topic, and, you know, I kind of related to it recently in real life as well. So I'm going to talk about the friend zone. So I got this message that goes a little something like this. First off, can't wait for the podcast tomorrow. I appreciate it. And secondly, why do I always get friend zoned? I either come off too strong or I come off as a friend. I'm not the douchebag type of guy or anything along those lines. I have manners and I treat women with great respect when it comes down to it. I always get the quote unquote just friend speech. And when I try to break out, I look like an idiot and lose a good friend. And then I got another one. This one's from a girl who says, I need your advice or opinion. Okay, I'm seeing this guy and I guess you could say we're friends with benefits. I have major feelings for him, but he doesn't have any for me. How do I ask or bring it up to him that I do have feelings and I want something more without him getting freaked out and kicking me to the curb? Seems guys tend to leave girls in the dust for catching feelings nowadays. Should I just leave him alone before my little heart gets broken into a million pieces? These are both excellent questions, and they kind of touch in the same subject matter, in the same realm. So I'm going to try to cover them both and tell you guys a little sad story about my life as well. So my theory on guys and girls being friends is like this. They can't be friends. And I hate saying that, and I wish that it weren't true. As I get older, though, I just think it is the truth. Men and women can't be friends because one of them is always going to be attracted to the other. There's this whole theory called the ladder theory that you guys should Google search. I've probably talked about it before, but it basically states that women have two ladders. One is a friendship ladder and one is a sexual attraction ladder upon which they rate men. Like their best friend would be at the top of their friendship ladder, and the person they're most attracted to would be on the top of their sexual attraction ladder or romantic interest ladder. And guys only have one ladder, and that is, which girl do I want to fuck the most? So, you know, if you're a guy that's close friends with a chick, chances are you either openly or secretly want to have sex with her or be in a relationship with her. You're just not being honest to her, and maybe sometimes you're not being honest with yourself. So first and foremost, to the girl who likes the boy and is letting him smash because she's friends with benefits and she really likes him, this shit always ends badly, in my opinion. I don't think friends with benefits ever quite works out because someone always catches feelings. And in my personal experience, what tends to happen is that the girl will catch feelings and then I might think, oh, she's catching too many feelings, and I break it off. And then in hindsight, I realize, like, oh, wait, I had feelings for her too. I just wasn't admitting it, you know? And so that might be something that happens with your dude. So by the time you tell him that you like him and he says, oh, I don't feel that way, and he breaks it off, by the time you're getting over it and dating someone else, that's when he's going to realize, like, oh, fuck, I'm miserable. And then he's going to start harassing you and et cetera, et cetera. And it's all bad. But I think that, yeah, the strong thing to do, the right thing to do, is bring it up. Take that chance. Tell him that you do have feelings for him and see what happens. The worst that he could say is that he doesn't feel that way, and then you know that you're wasting your time, because what happens in friends of benefit relationships is that you do both end up wasting your time. You have a false sense of security and comfort with him, and if he doesn't have the feelings for you, then he's just basically using you, which is not healthy for either person, and it keeps you from meeting the right person, and it keeps him from meeting the right person, and both of you are doing it for probably the wrong reasons. But I would say, yeah, go ahead and tell him. Now, to the guy who always ends up in the friend zone, this is something I've been struggling with. I'm going to get real here and talk about a friend zone situation that I was just in, where I made the mistake of trying to jump from a girl's friend ladder over to her sexual attraction ladder, and it just didn't work out. You know, I was pretty close friends with this girl for a couple of years, but circumstances always kept us from being able to like pursue anything romantically, even though I was pretty sure that both of us felt that way. And so, you know, when circumstances allotted us to actually go on some dates, we started going on some dates, and they went great. Or the first one, at least, went really great. And then, I don't know, for some reason, I felt myself kind of questioning, because she's trying to take things slow. And so I'm somebody who generally, when I go on a date, it's like, I'm usually having to go, hey, you know, we shouldn't fuck tonight. Tonight is the first date. We should probably not fuck, because we end up like maybe a heavy makeout session starts or something. Like, there's always a little bit of trouble there. So I'm like, if it's something that I like on a first date, I'm like, hey, we should slow down, because I'm terrible and I have a one track mind, and that happens. And so this girl, when we would go out, it was like there wasn't any kind of like physical it's not that there wasn't a physical connection. It's just that, you know, she wouldn't let me kiss her. We weren't holding hands. We weren't doing any of that stuff. So I was kind of like thinking in my head, like, fuck, am I in the friend zone? And then, yeah, it turned out that I was in the friend zone, because after the third or fourth date, she was kind of like, hey, look, I'm not really feeling dating. We tried. I had fun. That's it. And it hurts. It hurts to hear that, it sucks to hear that, oh, you're just a friend. But that shit happens sometimes. As far as staying out of the friend zone, I mean, this was clearly like I'm the dude that clowns on people that are in the friend zone, because I'm like, oh, you're just waiting your turn to date this girl? Like, nah, you're her best friend and she doesn't see you that way. Like, you need to recognize that. And I obviously did not recognize that, and I took my shot at it, and then I found out, like, yeah, I'm in the fucking friend zone. Oh, well, I'm still happy that I tried. I'm still happy that I said something. I'm still happy that I took my attempt and that it failed, because I would rather do that than continue on not pursuing something that I felt, you feel me? So to stay out of the friend zone, it's a tricky thing, because, like, as cliche as it sounds, like, women are always kind of attracted to dicks. Like, it just is what it is. Like, if you're not chasing, then you're better off. And so if you're someone who finds yourself doing the chasing, sometimes you just need to force yourself to act a little bit more aloof, perhaps, even if you give way too many fucks. If you give so many fucks that it's all you think about, you still need to, like, chill out and play the game, because there is definitely, like, they call it game for a reason. And sometimes it comes naturally, where you actually don't give a fuck and it just kind of falls into your lap. And other times, when you actually like somebody, you need to play the game of, like, okay, even though I want to text her right now, I should probably wait a few days so that it looks like I'm busy and I'm not thinking about this or that or the other. And, you know, acting aloof and not giving a fuck. And that's the thing, is I think that I usually don't really give that much of a fuck. And now I feel myself getting older and I'm like ready to settle down. And I think people can smell that on you. So, you know, people can sense when you're out searching for something. And I think that when you stop searching or really caring, that's when you actually meet somebody that's going to be that for you. I hope. Who knows? But as far as always being in the friend zone, man, I don't know. At a certain point, you just got to pull your socks up and man up and, like, not be friends with the girl. If you like her, don't fucking be her friend. Like, ask her on a date the first time you see her. Like, don't ever be a dude that a girl wants to cry to you about her boyfriend. As soon as a girl does that to you, you're never going to see her naked. As long as you can avoid that, you're going to be fine. As sad as it is, it's kind of true what they say, man. Like, sometimes nice guys finish last. And so, I don't know, maybe fucking tap into a darker side of your mentality. Maybe these girls that you're falling into the friend zone with will look at you as more of a threat, where if they let their guards down, they might end up naked around you. So, I don't know, man. Hopefully that helps. I'm not sure if it did or not, But let me know. If you're a girl listening to this and you were offended by me saying that he should act like more of an asshole sometimes, let me know. And if you're the dude who asked me the question and you start acting like more of an asshole and it works, let me know that too. Because I tend to think that, like, as I'm growing up, I'm trying to concentrate on not being as much of an asshole. And now that I do that, that's when I felt my mojo floundering. So perhaps I should just snap back into asshole mode and I'll be really out here again. Who knows? That is my rambling and probably half-ass shitty advice and my personal anecdote about being in the friend zone. And, you know, that happened a couple weeks ago, and it was a bummer. It was a bummer. But without any further ado, let's get into the conversation with my dude, Jeff Weiss, writer for the LA Weekly, LA Times, Passion of the Weiss, Rolling Stone, Pitchfork, you name it. He's written it. He's got a book out. This is a fun convo. This is the first time that we've had an extended conversation like this, and I had a good time. So I hope you guys will, too. Thank you for tuning in again. Here's Jeff Weiss. How'd you get the Laker job?
I was in Phil Jackson's book randomly. I went to the 2009
he quoted you.
Lakers parade. Yeah. And my friend was, I guess, in Mexico. And I got a text from him. And he's like, you're in Phil Jackson's book. And my initial instinct is, like, what did you do wrong? Like, slanderous, horrible journalist, Jeff. And then he's like, no, you're in the book. And I literally had not even...
From a weekly article or an
LA
Times?
4 years ago when the Lakers won the championship in 2009, I hit up the editor and I was like, hey, you should send me to the championship parade.
Yeah.
Because me and my friend just wanted to go.
And so you just wrote a piece on that?
Yeah, we got like amazing press access. They, you know, right down... It was in the Coliseum.
Yeah.
So there's like 80,000 screaming, insane... Like the streets were lined up on Figueroa downtown. It was like nuts. Like, I mean, people were dressed up. They were like, people dressed as Transformers. Yeah. It was the... I mean, you know, LA. Like one... We don't care about it. Like, there's no civic pride, like the millennium celebrations,
You're winning. No one cares unless they're winning.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, but it's funny too, because like the Clippers are winning and no one cares.
Yeah,
like they're like, I went to the Lakers practice yesterday and there was like media from every country. There's Chinese media like boxing me out to try to talk to, like, you know, Mike D'Antoni. And you're like, this is a 500 team.
Why? Because Kobe's coming back?
Because Kobe's coming back, yeah.
That's interesting. But you know what? By the time the playoffs start, if the Clippers are still contenders, then people will... All the Lakers fans will be Clippers fans. That's what
happens. Well, I feel like they're not mutually exclusive, but I feel like the Clippers fans is interesting because there's like a different subset. There's like a lot of Clippers fans. LA is such a transient town that there's people that came to LA 5 years ago, so they weren't there for like the Danny Manning, like Ken Norman, like... Benoit Benjamin years of the Clippers. Like I grew up here, so my dad would... Donald, he did like tax work for Donald Sterling.
Oh.
And Donald Sterling is the most crooked, awful man like alive from everyone. So he's like racist. There's horrible things that...
Wow.
There was like a lawsuit against him. He owns all these buildings and he would only rent Asian people, and like he would be like, no Mexicans, no blacks, because
Asians pay their rent on time.
He said something really...
Shout out to Ben.
No. He said something really... it was something like really racist like that, where it was like, you're like, no, don't say these things.
That's
owner of
fucked.
The Clippers. And then so he would try to not... He stiffed my dad of like all this money, and he owns like half of the West Side. But
no shit.
He stiffed my dad and then would try to pay him in like Clippers tickets. And my dad's like, no one wants your Clippers tickets.
Whoa.
So we would go to Clippers games sometimes.
That's tight.
Yeah.
Tickets are better than no tickets, regardless of the team.
I agree. That's why I'm covering the team.
Yeah, for sure. So you said you're from LA?
Yeah.
Born and bred.
Generations
here or what?
My grandmother came here, I guess, in the 40s, and they were trying to make them like the Shirley Temple.
Really?
Like, they were trying to make them like the next Shirley Temple, but she didn't have, I guess, enough pizzazz.
She was like young child star.
She was trying to be, but then like her, she was there, and then her family had... Benny Goodman was like the one that was like the one claim to fame on that side of the family. That was like her like first cousin.
Where were they from before that? New York?
Removed. Chicago. And then my dad's side came in the 50s from New York. They were all, you know, like immigrants from...
Jewish on both sides?
Jewish on both sides, yeah.
Russian or nose. Where from?
My mom's side is Russian. My dad's side is like Poland, Hungary, Czechoslovakia. A lot of them died.
Yeah, I'm a quarter Hungarian too.
Really? They all died in the Holocaust. So.
No shit.
Yeah, fun times.
Yeah, see, I think that my family, my mom's maiden name actually is Milkovitz, and it's like a Hungarian last name, but my grandfather and his, or my great-grandfather and his brothers like got out of Dodge right before the Holocaust.
Were they Jewish?
That's the thing, is that they say they're Lutherans, but they were never practicing, and all of them changed the spelling of their name when they came over. And I just kind of feel like maybe we have some secret.
How do you feel about a stuffed cabbage? Because that's real. That's real.
Hey,
what about lox?
You know, living in LA, I'll claim to have some kind of Judaism in my background when I need to.
Yeah,
I
mean, not a lot of Jews in Nome, I bet.
Yeah, well, I've never been to Nome.
Oh, you're not from Nome. Fairbanks. You're from outside of Fairbanks. Yeah, Fairbanks.
Yeah, no one. I don't know.
Did I think
I've never
North
been
Pole.
To North Pole. There
North
you go.
Pole. That was what I confused.
Yeah, good memory. Yeah.
I just think gnome is a funnier word, I guess.
Gnome is funny, and that's what
North Pole is like a predictable cliche joke, but gnome, you think of a mythological sprightly creature.
When I hear gnome, I just think of dog mushing.
I was pretty obsessed with gnomes for a while. Oh, yeah, gnome, because the dog mushing.
Yeah, dog mushing. I think the idea to Rod runs through there or whatever.
Yeah.
So anyhow, your folks are over here. Your grandmother's going to be a child star. Did she ever get into any acting?
No, she almost fucked Herr Belafonte once, but it didn't go through.
Really?
Yeah, my grandfather was, I think maybe a great-grandfather. I think might have a bit of a racist, actually.
Wow.
Stymied that.
Huh.
I think he gave her some flowers. She was like a pretty hot divorcee, I think, in like the early 50s.
Yeah.
They were at some like Catskills resort. Harry Belafonte saw my grandma, gave her a rose. My great grandfather was like, like, no.
That's so funny.
You're like, and I do not endorse my great grandfather's racism, but the guy was born in the 19th century, so. Psh.
Yeah,
bigotry
yeah.
is a motherfucker.
You got a lot of white guilt. You bring up racism. You bring up racism hella quick.
Yeah, yeah. Seriously, I actually don't.
Don't
I mean,
worry. This is a safe space.
I think because I'm Jewish, I don't have that much white guilt. Because I kind of, you know, not to say that like Jews aren't capable of racism, but no one liked us either.
Yeah, true.
So,
true.
You know, Kanye still doesn't. Apparently,
there you go.
Yeah.
So your dad was a tax what attorney?
He's a tax attorney. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, what's your mom about? What does
she
do?
Runs a baby boutique.
A baby boutique.
Yeah. For if you need any baby clothing, go to the Elegant Child.
The Elegant Child.
The Elegant Child. Shout out Terry Weiss and the Elegant
Child. Shout out to Mama Weiss and Elegant Child.
Yeah.
How long has she been doing that?
Like 12 years, I guess. 15 years.
Yeah.
20 years. Yeah, I was like a latchkey kid. Like just playing, you know. Not like that's a sob story or anything.
No, yeah, no.
Yeah, I mean, no, I have no sob story.
What part of town were you latchkeying in?
Oh, yeah. We had a condo in Beverly Hills.
Nice.
Which was it was kind of to go to, my dad always hated it, but it was good school district. So we bought they got a condo and it was like slums of Beverly Hills. So it's like always like, that's why I like that movie was so funny because there's obviously no slum in Beverly Hills, but it's like, there's always this kind of discrepancy between, you know, like really.
Yeah, the difference between the middle class and the upper middle class, there's probably a lot.
Well, and also like the really rich people all go to private school. Like the kids that go to public school, they're obviously wealthy. You know what I mean? But it's like any wealthy suburb anywhere in America. The private school kids, they're all children of actors. Like, you know, when you think of Beverly Hills, you think of the mansions, you think of the children of actors. Those are all the people that go to private. Harvard West, like Brentwood, Crossroads.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, so I like saying because the truth is like, you know, I grew up like a block from LA. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It wasn't like, there was not really a difference, but thank God Alchemist and Ariel Pink came from Beverly Hills. So it kind of,
So now you have street cred.
It's not even that. It's like, I thought that like nothing good could ever come from Beverly Hills. Like I was like, pretty much if you came from Beverly Hills, you're just designed to like, you know, I mean, not to slander it because I'm sure there's, but it's like actor, you know, it's like I'm going to be a lawyer. I want to be a doctor, and which is great, but not anyone creative. Usually you think like, there's always the myth of, you know, like the, you know, started from the bottom myth, or then there's like the really crazy person that totally, I mean, I guess which Ariel Pink would probably fit into, but then you see someone like Alchemist who fucking producing from Mobb Deep.
Yeah.
You know, like might as well be the third member of Mobb Deep.
Right, right.
So then you realize that it's all, you know, it's not to quote Rakim, the where you're from, it's where you're at, but you know, it's true, kind of.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not like I'm any kind of hardcore person.
No, I mean, I would compare you to Rakim.
I mean, I think I'm more of a Big Daddy Kane type.
There you go.
Yeah.
Because you never half step.
And I fucked Madonna.
Oh my God. Madonna is the same age as my mother. That's so disturbing.
Yeah.
Literally, they're a month different. So when people tell me, like, oh, Madonna still is pretty hot, I'm like, ew.
Yeah, no, never.
Yeah. So do you get recognized in school as being a pretty gifted kid very early on? Where you seem like you're pretty you're a well-read guy. You're a well-spoken guy. Did you excel at everything, or was just writing an instant passion?
No, writing actually was not a passion at all. I was like a jock. That was like my thing. I mean, I did really well in school, but it was never like my identity. It was never like, oh, you're the smart kid.
Yeah,
you know what
I
mean? Like I was always pretty much near the top of the class, if not at it. But
yeah,
like it never was like –
How big were the schools you were going to as a kid?
You know, 30 kids in a class. It wasn't like, you know, it wasn't like they were good schools, but it wasn't like amazing. You know, I think the private schools, like, if
the reason I ask is, like, I mean, like, overall, because, like, my school, it was small. We had 400 kids total because I was in a small town. So it was like the jocks and the smart kids and the whatever, they all blended together because everybody had to kind of play multiple roles.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't that big, you know, so it was not, but I mean, I was like, I thought, you know, I'd be like a professional baseball player or a basketball player. Until I realized, like, not that many 6'3 Jews in the NBA, so that was out.
Yeah.
And then, but I thought baseball players, and then,
yeah, 6'3 is a good size for a baseball player.
Yeah, well, Sean Green, it was like the Sean Green era. So you're like, oh, you could be like Sean Green.
Yeah.
And you realize, like, Sean Green was
How early did you start playing ball?
Like, 4.
At 4?
Yeah. Like, I had apparently a hoop at 2, and, like, my mom was like, you know, it was like when, you know, it's like, you know, they all have the NBA stories. They're like, my son was amazing. Like, it's like that story, except, like, it, like, went nowhere.
Yeah, yeah. What about baseball? Same age?
Like, 4, baseball. Yeah, my mom, like, baked brownies and, like, bribed them to let me in early. Because I was my sport. Like, you know, it's interesting, because did you ever read the Malcolm Gladwell? I think it was Outliers.
I did read that
book. You know how he talks about the hockey players?
Yeah, the age thing.
That was me with sports. And like when I read that book, I always suspected that, because especially if you're like kind of a late bloomer.
Like
sort
you
of
were born at the right time or the wrong
time? The wrong time.
Me too, dude. Yeah. I was a July baby. So my cutoff was like, I was always the youngest person in the league.
Uh-huh.
I've always thought the same thing. I'm like, damn, if I was only a couple months older than the cutoff.
Yeah, I was October. So I would play like with the kids a year younger. But then in high school, like I was always a year ahead. So it was sort of, you know, I came to high school. I was like, you know, 5'7 or something.
Oh, really? When did you hit your growth spurt?
Like junior year. I went from like sophomore with junior. I went like 5'10, 6'1. And then I was 6'2 by senior. I grew an inch in college.
Crazy. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because I mean, like, you know, it just also like, you know, just like built like a Jewish kid. Like I was like a stereotype. Like I wasn't like muscular or anything. I was kind of
Same. No, I was very passionate about baseball as well, and I didn't hit my growth spurt, my last growth spurt, until college. When I graduated high school, I think I was only like 5'10 160 or something.
Really. What position do you play?
I'm left-handed, so I used to play a lot of first base. I pitched and I played outfield, etc. The only things that we can do, essentially.
Yeah, that's the problem. I mean, like, that's the good thing about being lefty, but yeah, you're limited to like 3. They put me in outfield when I was in college.
Well, the funny thing about being left-handed though as a pitcher is that like I wasn't a great pitcher. I didn't have good velocity, but for some reason being left-handed confused the shit out of people.
Totally.
I had a decent curveball, but like people couldn't
hit
me.
Well, you have movement. You have a lot of movement.
Yeah, that was the thing. Like even my fastball tailed a little bit.
Yeah, mine had like apparently like it was my problem was I never like my dad's like a, you know, it was like a tax lawyer. It wasn't like a baseball family. So I feel like baseball is one of those things where it's basketball is kind of like more like wild style, kind of just like, you know, it's like, you know, everyone compares it to jazz. Baseball is more of a formalist game where it's like you really have to have those coaches and get your
fundamentals.
Basketball, Matt, your footwork is important, but like, you know, you can pick that up kind of easy. Pitching, I had really bad mechanics, so I would like, but I threw pretty hard, and like I had like a
crate. How hard did you throw?
Probably hardest I ever threw was like 87, 88. Like,
nice.
You know, like not consistent, like probably consistently like 84, 85.
Yeah.
And then I had like a nice, I had a really great slider. That was like my best pitch. Like, I was pretty great against lefties, but I just did not have control. Like when I pitched in college, they had signs where they'd be like, oh, you know, here's the location sign and here's the pitch. I never knew what the location sign was because I was like, who fucking cares? It doesn't matter.
Yeah, yeah.
Just going to throw it. Like, hopefully it's a strike. So I never had that. But I was also like not like the smartest like baseball player. Like I should have. I needed somebody that I was like was just too ADD, I think.
Yeah.
And unfocused and thought I could throw. I thought I could throw, blow by everybody. And I didn't realize like if you take 2 or 3 miles off your fastball and spot it, they're not going to be able to hit it.
Yeah. Were you a good hitter?
Yeah, I was a pretty good hitter. I like played first in college and DH'd a lot. And,
word.
Like, yeah, it was not that much power. I was kind of like a poor man's, really very poor man's Mark Grace. Like high average, never struck out, but not that much. I'd hit like bombs in batting practice, but I didn't have the just a little too anxious, you know, like I would swing first pitch and like as a hitter, like I think baseball is a game of I think all sports are really like not celebrated enough for their intelligence because they're just,
well, baseball is definitely the thinking man's sport. It's chess. It's a slow fucking moving
pitchers
game.
Pitchers especially. Yeah. I think like it, and that was also a problem too. I feel like you have to think like a pitcher and you have to think like a hitter.
I was just going to say like having experience pitching actually made me such a better hitter because I'd be like, oh, okay, 2-1 right now. If I was pitching, I would try to throw a strike right now because I wouldn't want to fall behind 3-1. And so like 2-1 was my favorite pitch to throw at because I felt like a pitcher was always going to throw a strike at me.
Yeah.
You feel me?
That makes sense. I mean, I would always just, I just like would do the same in the same game. So I would just not like, you know, I'd be like too obsessed. So if I wouldn't get a hit, then I'd take it out to the mound. And if I had a bad inning, then I'd carry it to the plate. So I was just a fucking head case.
Mm.
So moral of the story is get your child a sports psychologist young.
Did you spend a lot of time as a youth like doing camps and stuff like that? Like, were your parents really supportive of it or what?
Yeah. I mean, like, yes and no. Like, I went to a couple basketball camps and stuff. Mm-hmm. I went to sports camps. I never went to, like, sleepaway camp. We were too cheap, though. They would never. I mean, like, we weren't rich or anything. Right. So it was like, my dad's like, I'm not going to send you to $3,000 sleepaway camp or whatever. Right. I mean, to be honest, like, at the time, I was like, Dad, you're the worst, all my friends. And then, like, now I'm like, I don't think I would send my kid to it. I'm like, we're making $3,000 to send a fucking kid to.
Right. That's crazy.
So what is he going to fall? What the fuck is the point of
in hopes that he gets a contract for some shit, like a pipe dream.
It was like more, I'm saying, like, sleepaway camp for like archery. Like, you know what I mean? Like, what the fuck? What are you going to get, an archery scholarship?
Yeah.
Like, you know, what do you need arts and crafts for?
Right.
You know, but like I went to like a Magic Johnson basketball camp, which was like, that was like the highlight when I was like, you know, 10.
And he was there?
Yeah, he was there. He was my favorite player.
Oh, that's so dope.
And then he yells at me. Oh. it was like, because I'm stupid. And it was picture day, you know, so it's a. It's like Magic Johnson. It's like, get your bit. And like, so like Magic, you know, was taking his photo with like 3,000 asshole kids, you know? And so like
he's like having to be Santa Claus that day. It's like, a mall line.
So yeah, so many kids sitting on your lap. It's just the worst thing ever. And so like, I walk in front of, after I take my picture, I walk in front of the other picture and then Magic's like, what are you doing, kid? Like, what the fuck? You know, I'm like, oh, Magic Johnson yelled at me. But it was cool. I ended up like getting to play in front of like the whole camp in a one-on-one. There was like a one-on-one tournament for like my age, and I was like totally like,
you're killing it.
But I lost. Oh, well, story of my life.
But it's still.
But it was tight. Yeah. So that's why I thought, oh yeah. And then, you know, every kid thinks they're gonna go to the NBA. I think.
Yeah, totally. I mean, my first dream similarly was like, I want to be a pro baseball player. And
totally.
And then I was like, oh wait, I live in Alaska, and it's very like, there's no.
There any pro baseball players? Some basketball players. There's Boozer Trajan Langdon.
Yeah, there's a lot of basketball players actually. Trajan Langdon. There was Boozer.
Yeah.
I think they went to the same school. They're both from Juneau. Mm-hmm. There's a few dudes that are from Alaska, but baseball wise, it's pretty tough because we only have a 3-month summer.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There was actually one kid from my high school who graduated maybe like 4 or 5 years after me, who ended up playing for the Pirates as a pitcher for a while, which was like, I think that's like the only dude from my school.
You know what, in hindsight about baseball, because I, you know, I played in college and I went to a D3, like I didn't get really heavily recruited or anything, like, because I was younger and like just, you know, it just wasn't. I went to a D3 because I figured, all right, I'll start right off the bat, you know, like, and I, which I did. And I was like, oh, you'll just transfer in 2 years to like a D1 or like a good D2. And, you know, but I just, you know, like, you get a girlfriend, you like your school, you don't really want to fucking
start
smoking lots of weed and you're like
drinking beers. Partying.
You're like, you're like, why, you know, and it was pretty fun. And, but if I'd known how much money they made, I would have totally done steroids.
Oh,
like all these guys on my team were like, "Whoa, you need to juice,
dude!"
they were all juicing on my team. Like, half my team was juicing.
Oh yeah, that's so big in college sports. People don't realize it, man. My friend, I had a friend that got a scholarship for wrestling.
Yeah,
and he was like a heavyweight wrestler, and he started juicing in college and got fucking yoked. And then
you
all
get
the,
amazing.
All
when you
this,
juice.
He got injured, and I see him like a year and a half later, and he's fat as shit. And I go, I'm like, dude, what the fuck happened? He's like, man, I was like juicing in college, and then when I got off, it just turns you into fat bitch.
Yeah, you have to like lift. Like,
yeah, dude, he looked like shit afterwards.
These guys on my team were juicing and they got amazing. Like, and I was good. So, like, you know, I didn't realize, like, oh, you know, when like Eric Gagne, you remember when like, it was the time when Eric Gagne was in the Dodgers. So you'd read all these sports stories and like, Eric Gagne long tossed all offseason and came back with a 96 mile an hour fastball.
And it's like, no.
And then I saw it like long toss and I was like, all right, cool. You went from like 84 consistently to 85 consistently or 86 maybe. And I thought you could get like 5 or 6 miles. In hindsight, if I'd known, like, I didn't know what $1 million was when I was in college.
Yeah.
You just assume like, oh, that's a lot of money, but you'll make a lot of money doing everything. But if I'd known, I totally would have done it.
Right.
Because I was like, wait, you're making
baseball is definitely
$3 million a year as a low paid player.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, what would you do with $3 million?
It's the best sport to get into as a professional because it's the least likely that you'll get injured and you got the longest career and you get the highest, like,
the longest career. You can be good
whatever.
At 35. Look at Kobe. Yeah. He's like kind of probably done at 35.
Yeah.
And or he might be done.
You think he's done?
I think he's done as a dominant player.
Yes.
Yeah, I think he's done as a good defensive player.
I feel like the Lakers shouldn't have re-signed him.
It's like, here's the, like, I mean, I was actually just I've been writing about it. I was just reading Phil Jackson's book from 2004.
Yeah.
And there's an amazing quote where Phil's like, you need to trade Kobe. Like, Phil wanted to trade Kobe like from jump, like not from jump, but like from 2000 to 2004, they just had clashed. And then Genie's like, look, he's 26 years old. He's going to be the face of this team for 8 or 9 or 10 years.
Yeah.
Like, That's ticket sales. That's endorsements. That's mystique. That's, you know what I mean? The whole night. And you're like, oh, well, the, like, for them to not give him the contract, because, like, there's a chance, like, Kobe, kind of an asshole. Like, Kobe fucking will walk and sign with Dallas or something.
Right, right.
And then, like, what happens? Like, then they get no season ticket renewals, which they wouldn't, because, like, we're a delusional bunch of Lakers fans, you know, for valid reasons, invalid reasons, you know, whatever. But they've had a lot of success. So you assume, like, oh, Kobe Bryant's going to just be amazing. And, like, I watched him practice yesterday. And me, I'm like, it's going to be old Kobe. And then you see him and you're like, you dunked like me at 32.
Yeah,
I don't know about that.
I mean, I don't know about the politics and I don't pay attention that much and shit. But it seems to me it's like, why not just let the team suffer really bad for a couple of years so they get some good draft picks and try to find the next
Kobe? I think that's like the pragmatic. Like, that's like if you just approach it from like not like this tunnel vision thing, very clearly. But like, I feel, you know what, if I was the owner, I mean, I would have tried to bargain him down a little bit because the salary cap is pretty the CBA makes it pretty hard. But
when you have an athlete like that that people are so intrigued by, it's the same thing with like Mike Tyson. People wanted to see him fight long after his prime and long after he should have stopped, because it's just like, oh, maybe he'll still have flashes of his greatness.
Totally.
You know?
And it's like the kind of concept, it's like, I always think about it with music. It's like, I don't know, would you rather hear like a good album from like a decently talented band, like a good, you know, the best that they can do, or like, would you rather hear like Neil Young make like a mediocre record? And then there's like the kind of like thought, I'm like, I don't know, like I kind of like some of Neil Young's mediocre records, because you're like, how many, what do you need? You just need like one or two songs, right? But I mean, sports isn't like that, obviously, but like it's that same idea, I think.
Because even that mediocre Neil Young album will still have some moment of greatness.
Yeah, it'll be like a flash
of
genius.
Just like Kobe will still have some moments of greatness.
Yeah, he's gonna have, you know, he'll have that, like, I bet he puts up 45 in one game within maybe his first 20 games back. And then, like, everyone's going to, you know, you're going to read the article, Kobe's back. Kobe's back. How's he doing it? Because, I mean, sports is like, everything is built on a narrative. It's a data. So the difference is sports and albums. It's like music. It's like an album by album narrative, or sometimes like an EP by EP.
Yeah.
Sometimes even single by single. But sports is like a daily basis. It's a 24-hour news cycle like politics.
So. Yeah. Speaking of narratives, let's get into why you're here. You are a prolific writer. You're a known writer. You've written about music now for how many years?
Like professionally since 07. Six years.
Yeah, that's a good amount of time. And now you're converting into the sports writing, right? Yeah. Why? More lucrative?
You know, it's just a
less opinion, less opinion based, or what?
Well, it's definitely equally, it's more fun for me.
Yeah.
Like, honestly, like at a certain point, like I never really liked negative criticism.
Yeah.
I do it sometimes, like probably more infrequently than some, probably more frequently than others, but I don't like that aspect of it. It's just not enjoyable. And at a certain point, like what music writing is sort of, I mean, it's not. How are you going to do that as a profession at like 45 years old?
Yeah.
I mean, people do, and like I have respect for those who do, but
your tastes change over time. It's hard to remain.
Who wants to be like the young, cool? I never was interested in being like, I was like, I'm like naturally misanthropic. I'm naturally like not like I'm never going to be like the mainstream guy. Like I never was when I was young, but I love things when they're popular sometimes. It's totally at random.
Yeah.
But I just never want to be like, I never wanted to be the guy that's like, oh, let me tell. I mean, is there anything more contemptuous than like being like some 38-year-old white guy telling like 16-year-old black kids or 19-year-old black kids the way that they should be making music? Like that's kind of awful. Like, you know what I mean? Like, and it's not awful necessarily in the abstract, because you know what I mean, criticism is criticism, it's gonna always, but at the same time, like there's just no, it's not why I started writing.
Right.
And you know, it's not like I went out to be a music writer.
Well, why did you start writing?
Well, that's a long story, but basically
what we have time for.
Well, basically you know, I never was like one of those like creative writing kids. I loved reading. I was a very, very, very obsessive reader. Like, you know, I'd go to the library all summer, like when I wasn't playing sports.
When did you get a passion for reading? Very young?
Four. Yeah, I started reading at four, and I would just go to like, you know, it'd be sports and then just reading. I would just read obsessively, like everything. I read like every book in my library. I read every sports book in the library too, which is why sports writing made sense.
Have a book from like a few different eras of your life that may have changed your life at the time? Like, do you have a book as a 7-year-old where you're like, oh, this shit is like, whoa.
God.
And then in high school,
I don't think so. I liked Matt Christopher books when I was a kid. Like, he wrote these baseball and sports books. I really loved those.
You know what I used to fuck with heavy? Two things. I used to fuck with Encyclopedia Brown.
Oh, I was going to say Encyclopedia Brown.
Yeah. And also Choose Your Own Adventure books.
Those were great. I loved those.
Those were like what made me passionate about reading very early on.
I loved the Wizard of Oz books, actually.
I never read any of those.
They had 45. Wizard of Oz books. No, and I was like really into them. One or two summers, I got like obsessed with it. And like I never was really a fantasy, but I liked that. They had I was so into baseball stuff. You know what I mean? Like the 100 greatest baseball players. Like I would like memorize that shit. Like I would read like Magic Johnson's autobiography. I was like obsessed with sports. Charles Barkley's autobiography. You know, like I thought those were so cool. Because you know, you're still like, I never was like, I, you know, like I said, like my, there were no books in my house.
Yeah.
My parents didn't own books. I mean, like,
they weren't readers.
They were educated, but they're not like
leisure readers.
No, I like, I don't, I've never known either of them to read a book ever. You know, I bought my dad. Yeah. It, and there was not really any TV. There was like no media. There weren't movie people. There weren't music. There were no records in my house. Sort of like growing up in an Amish household.
No records either. So
yeah, no records. There was one that was like Thriller, which was a good one to
have.
That's
a good one to have.
Yeah.
How did, so was the developing a passion for reading and a passion for music like this like kind of silent rebellion or something? Like how does that happen?
No,
How did you get into music?
It's funny. I never really like, I've never like been interested in rebelling against my parents. They were always like, I mean, like my dad and me like had quarrels, you know, but like, you know, we didn't have a great like relationship growing up, but it wasn't like I always thought it was kind of trite, I think, to be like, oh, I'm just going to rebel for the sake of being, I definitely like tried my cigarettes, you know, I was like, you got drugs, I'll try them. But I never really wasn't very successful at procuring them until like my sophomore year. And even then I wasn't, I've kind of inherently been sort of I'm a very irresponsible responsible person.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It was when I was actually in college and I had a friend that, you know, I got there and I was, you know, like you're in college, you're like smoking lots of weed and you're like interested in trying to find out things. And I had a friend in the dorms who was like, I was always really into rap. Like I was obsessed with rap from like, you know, Chronic came out when I was like 10. So it was like, shit. So, you know what I mean? It's like, whereas I just turned 11.
Well,
so
that,
like,
must,
that,
been,
shit
that must have been a huge record in LA.
Oh, God.
For a little
yeah.
Jewish white kid.
Oh, I mean, for everyone.
Yeah.
I mean, no. it was wild.
I always think of that scene in, what's the Chris Rock one that they did?
CB4.
CB4. The little Jewish record executive's child.
It was the politician's son.
There you go. It was the politician's son. He's walking around looking like Bud Bundy in the Raiders jacket.
Totally. I mean, like, Bud Bundy was like running LA. Like, you know what I mean? Alchemist. Like, everyone knew like who Alchemist was.
Grandmaster,
you know?
B.
He was like Little D or something. He's David Foster, you know. Yeah, everyone knew who Alchemist was because, like, you know, so everyone's like, all my friends, their older brothers, like, knew, you know, they were friends with like Al and Scott and them, and they were like all the cool guys, like 3 years older, and like, so you knew about them, and they had Hooligans at the time.
Oh, so that was
like, and then they had like the show on KBEV. It was called Funky Flavas.
Yeah.
And
what's KBEV, like local radio?
It was like local TV. Yeah.
Like cable access?
Yeah, it was like Wayne's World. Like,
that's tight.
But it was from the high school. Like, that was like, they had some crazy, some teacher was like, you know, really with it. And so they would show like rap. They had this amazing show. I've been trying to get the videos out there. They exist. I've watched them again.
Yeah.
But it was this guy, Adam Weissman. Do you know Pollen?
No.
He works for Stussy. He's in this really good band called Pollen. And he was one of the producers of the show. Mike Caron, who like is the head of an A&R at Warner Brothers.
Yeah.
One of like the camera people. He was like involved with it. And Alchemist was the host.
Wow.
So they would have like this diner called Larry Parker's, and they'd have like, you know, Alchemist interviewing Mast Ace, Alchemist interviewing Farside, like, you know what I mean? Like, and they'd show all these amazing videos. So that really, that was like on top of Yom TV Raps, there was like Funky Flavas, and that was like, you know, my friend's older brother was Mike Caron. So he would be like, my brother's doing the show. And I'm like, you know, I'd watch it. I was obsessed with it. So
that's so tight.
Yeah. And I was like, you know, BT Rhapsody would on site, like tape. You know,
when's that, like 92, 93?
That must have been 92, 93. Yeah. I was young. I was like, you know, 10, 11, 12.
Yeah.
And so I would just become obsessed with that. And then,
what were some of the earliest rap records you got into, like The Chronic, and then what else?
I love Passing Me By. That was like my favorite record. I mean, the first one I really remember is like probably Humpty Dance. I really remember loving Humpty Dance.
That's my karaoke jam.
Yeah, that's mine too.
Yeah.
I can do it. I was like, all right, stop what you're doing because I'm about to ruin the image.
See,
of
I never do the voice. Yeah, that's good.
I was Humpty for Halloween like 3 years ago.
That's tight.
It was like, it'd be like, yeah, give me all your crackers and your licorice. You know, so I'd just do that. And then I would.
Are you ticklish?
Yeah.
Anyhow, you got into Digital Underground, or was it just the single?
No, I bought Sex Packets.
Yeah.
I love Sex Packets. I mean, it was like really, and then Doggy Style. And then,
Doggy
like,
Style was a huge record.
You know, I had a lot of tape singles. I had a lot. Like, I was really into New Jack Swing.
Oh,
I liked BBD a lot when I was like sixth grade.
Do Me Baby.
Oh yeah.
I should not have been listening to that when I was in fourth grade, but I was super down.
Only two things I ever ordered in the box were Do Me and Poison. Never came.
That's tight.
Yeah. It's like, I know,
you're the first person that I've met that has ever said they called the box. Cause yeah. I used to watch the box.
It's a
one
time thing. Like, cause it was like a big deal. Cause like, my parents were not like $3. Like, you're not getting $3.
I feel like if I would have called that 900 number and put in a credit card, I would have fucking gotten my head chopped off.
Totally. I was like, come on, please. Yeah. One thing.
Yeah.
Never came. I was like, I'm not asking you again.
That's so funny. You know, a box single I used to really like that they played a lot was A Lighter Shade of Brown.
Oh, yeah.
That was like, hey, D.
Oh, Hey DJ was the homies they also had all the time.
I loved that fucking song.
LA Rap was amazing then. So it was like, it's really easy. And Power 106 was amazing. Baker Boys were playing like whatever the fuck they wanted. And the Crossover was, I loved Crossover.
Yeah.
That was one of my favorite early songs.
So did you stay into rap like the whole junior high school the whole time?
I had like a year where I got into grunge. But like I liked rap still, but like I was really into like Nirvana, Smashing Pumpkins, Pearl Jam, like Alice in Chains.
Was that like 8th or 9th grade?
It's like 8th.
I feel like we have a similar trajectory because it's like you go through this thing where like rap is your first love and you're like you're kind of confused about that because like a lot of like there's a lot of anti-white
it's
shit.
Like, and it's like, are you a rap kid?
Yeah.
I'm like, I never was like trying to be like the, you know, the quote unquote what you were called a wigger at the time.
Yeah, exactly.
I never was into that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think I probably had like wig tendencies, and so
I owned a couple Maurice Malone and Echo things.
Yeah, like, yeah, there you go.
But never FUBU.
I had Cross Colors and some Carl Kanai.
Yeah. I never went that far.
Yeah,
When
I go back home to North Pole, I have the same boudoir or dresser thing
awesome.
From like when I was a child, and it's got this mirror on it, and on the mirror has like stickers from all the clothes.
Oh, I have that too.
So it's got Cross Colors. It's got fucking old Stussy, like super old Stussy. I don't know.
Yeah,
it's, like,
I had like the old Ed Band Clan, like pre-Black Eyed Peas.
Yeah,
I had like all that shit, like Triple Five Soul and Mecca.
Forgot about Mecca. That's tight.
Yeah.
Then at some point, like at the end of my 8th grade year, I went like, wait, maybe I should try listening to white people music and see what it's about. And it was like, I went through this little phase of that. And then I realized that you have to live in both worlds because like music is music.
Yeah.
Me. Yeah.
Although I really didn't like, I went right back into it. I think like after like 8th grade, like I think I like went away. It was like I had a friend that was like, I'm gonna go to Club Med with my family, wanna come? Like I was like,
what's Club? Where is Club Med? I always thought that was like a made up place. What is
it? Like I went to it. It was lame.
Where is it?
Like in Mexico. And I remember being there like it was Huatuco. And I remember being there and like I thought it was the cheesiest shit ever. Like all these people are like doing like electric slides and like the Macarena. And like here I am in like 8th grade. I'm like, this is the corniest shit ever. Like I was like such a cynical fuck.
But there's like no other 13-year-old broads to holler at or something?
I was definitely unsuccessfully hollering at a couple girls.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, I was doing my best.
Dude, 8th grade summer vacations were the best for summer. Love, I was so about that.
Yeah, I was like not that. I was a little too like I tried a little too hard.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
I needed like an older brother to be like, yes.
The thirst was real.
Yeah, the thirst was way too real, and I was like, I don't understand why these girls, you know, and like someone needed to be like, yo, just ease up a little bit. You're cool,
it's right?
Fine. But yeah, no. So and then like I think I brought like Warren G, which I'd bought the year before, and like I became re-obsessed with Warren G. And then somebody there were these two guys one guy was like a white guy, was like a white hippie dude. They must have been like 19 at the time, but I thought they were like impossibly old. And there was another dude, his name was Doc, and he was like this black dude with an afro and mutton chops. And there was like a party that someone threw, and I had like the one boombox I'd brought lugged my boombox to Mexico because I wanted tapes.
Yeah.
And they left like the only bill for Cuban Links tape.
Oh, okay.
And Craig Mack Project Funk to World in my tape player. And they left, and I was like, someone gave me a purple tape. And I didn't understand it, but I liked it. I was like, what is this?
Right, right.
It took me like 3 years to get, but. And then so that kind of got me back into hip hop, and then like, you know.
So in high school, you're still the hip hop kid.
Yeah, yeah. And then.
What else were you college, into? What else were you into in high school? Was it just sports and rap music?
And the girls. I was really boring.
Yeah, yeah.
TV. No, that's I was like good. Really into pop culture.
Did you start fucking around with like drinking, anything like that?
I did, but like nothing heavy. Like I was never like really like. You can't be that much of a problem kid when you're like. You get kicked off the teams.
Right, right.
You know, if you got bad grades or if you – and my guys out would whoop my ass.
What would your baseball coach say about your hair right now?
They probably would have been like, you always knew he was a fuckboy. You know, they would have been like, I always knew that kid was a lefty. They'd be like, oh, he's a lefty.
Yeah.
Lefties are weird. Because
you got long, wavy locks. You know, the funny thing is, back when I could grow hair, my freshman year of high school, I made the varsity team, and I had, at the time, the hip hairstyle was to shave underneath and part down the middle.
I remember that. Yeah.
My shit was down to my shoulders. And
middle part with a number two step.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I remember my coach, little tiny black dude named Billy, and he's like, Shana's the crazy, he's the wild child on the team, look at his hair. And then I came with a haircut one time and he was like, why'd you cut your hair, man, why'd you do it? Like, and yeah, it, man, was such a disappointment.
It was funny when I was in college, it was like a freshman in college, like, where the whole team was going to Hawaii, right? And like, yeah, it was like some, like, you had to like raise money all year, so we could like, the whole team like sold shirts and we like raised money so we could get this trip to Hawaii, which was fucking like the most like every horrible thing you could expect happened in Hawaii with a bunch of like 18-year-old to 21-year-olds in Hawaii. Like, and they all, my team had like the bright idea. They're like, yo, let's shave our heads and bleach them.
Oh, fuck.
And then I was like,
because of 311.
Yeah, it was like, dude, it was like 90. It was like 2000. It was like that Slim Shady era, you know?
Oh, yeah.
It was like right.
It was like Limp Bizkit and Slim Shady.
It's like, you know how in like 21 Jump Street when Jonah shows up with like looking like Eminem. Yeah. I mean, I was the one guy on the team that didn't do it. And they were like, you're an asshole. Like, why didn't you do this? You know,
that's fun. I was doing literally the same exact thing at that time. I shaved my head and had bleach blonde hair. And looking back, it's some real kook shit. But at the time, the ladies loved it.
Oh, yeah. Like, I just knew my nose was too big. I looked stupid with a fucking shaved head. I was like, you will not let go of the shaved head.
Yeah.
So, yeah. No.
Were you getting into writing in high school, though? Like, did you know that you had a penchant for it?
No. I loved books, I always thought the creative writing kids were kind of corny.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, oh, I'm a writer. I'm like, I know you're doing that to get bitches.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, ladies. Sorry, I say that in Lupe Fiasco in my head. It's like, stop saying that word. But I was using it to quote somebody. But, yeah, I never, like, I always thought it was the creative writing thing. I did a speech contest once and I lost. And like, I was like, I don't know. I always had this thought in the back of my head. I don't know why, where it was like, if it's right for you, then you'll do it. Like, you'll know that's your thing.
Right.
I always suspected I could, but I was like, I don't know. I always just assumed at some point in my life I would become a writer or I wouldn't. And I never thought about it because also, like, honestly, like, being a baseball player looked like a lot more like a viable option than being a writer, because I come from a family where, like, my dad loves baseball. He doesn't love writing. So it's like, you know, and he was like encouraging. He wasn't really like helping me out with baseball or anything, but like he, you know, that was pretty good. And it made sense that like that would, you know, I was like, oh, I'll just be a lawyer. I didn't know what a lawyer was. It was like making, you know, it's like, my dad was a lawyer. Like, my uncle was like, you know.
So when you went off to college, was that the intent? Was
yeah,
like, I'm going to get a law degree?
Totally. I mean, it's like, there's like a funny joke. They're like, what's a lawyer? And it's like, it's a Jew who doesn't like blood. It's like totally anti-Semitic, but kind of true. Cause it's like, yes, yeah, it's like you're supposed to be a doctor or a lawyer if you're Jewish or like something responsible. And, you know, it makes sense. Cause it's like, you know, if you look back and study the history of Jewish people, there's like, you know, history of persecution, and they were always making money and getting thrown out of town. So when you get thrown out of town, you better have some fucking money to go to the next town and get me persecuted. So, you know, you always assume, like, fuck, someone's out to get us. So, like, save your fucking money because this is not going to last.
Right.
And I think that's why when people are like, oh, Jews are good with money, it's like, no, they're not, like, that good with money. They just don't spend it because they assume it's not going to be there. You know? And I think that's...
I feel like I read something where, like, part of the thing about why Jews are good with money comes from, like, back in ancient times, Judaism was one of the religions where you could loan...
Yeah, well, it's part of... They were the only ones, like, in the Middle Ages...
That could collect...
Yeah, you couldn't handle money. It was, like, deemed unclean by the Christian church. So Jews were one of the only people that loan money. That's why a lot of the banking families in the Middle Ages, like the Rothschild.
Well, and then it's funny that you brought up outliers, because there's the story about like how Jews became such powerful lawyers with corporate law, because that was like at the time corporate law wasn't
the
a big
thing.
It was the worst thing to be.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden it became the most important thing to be.
Totally.
You know, and so that's why there's so many.
Yeah. Like, I mean, and not to say that like all, I mean, I think now like the stereotype is probably like less true, because I think like, you know, there's been successions of Jewish kids that have grown up with money, and usually by the third generation that grows up with a decent amount of money just squanders it. Also, like, no one really.
It's from super wealthy to broke in three generations.
Yeah, like, I used to cover, like, I was briefly a business reporter and for about a year and a half, and I would do family businesses, and they're like, first generation founds a business, builds it, second generation expands it, takes it to its peak, third generation loses it.
Because they want to play Xbox all day on the couch and shit.
But just like, you don't have that hunger. So that was the thing, like, my dad, that was, I think, why I've been able to do okay with writing is because it was my dad was very much like, you're entitled to nothing.
You have to work hard.
Yeah. Do it yourself. Don't be an asshole. Like, be respectful. Like, you know, like, I mean, I had a bad attitude, of course. And like my, you know, but I would just, that was like always what I'd hear. Like, you have, your coach says you have a bad attitude, your teacher. And like, so you just get screamed at.
Yeah.
And I still probably have a bad attitude, which is kind of why writing made sense, because it's like, you can professionally have a bad attitude.
Right.
You know, it's like, well, it's a good, it's a writer. It's just an artful complaint.
Yeah.
So then basically what happened was my freshman or sophomore year, I had a friend that was like really, you know, like I remember I went to, he like, you know, he was like really into like Jack Kerouac, and like I never read like, you know, I like was not like, the schools were good, but they weren't like great, you know?
Yeah.
So when I never read like Catcher in the Rye, I never read like Great Gatsby. I never read like, you know, On the Road, books that like, you know, a lot of, I mean, not to say that they, it, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And so I read them and I got really inspired, but I never still thought I'd be a writer. I had a girlfriend my sophomore or junior year, and she lived in the Bay. So I'd go up and I'd go to City Lights and kind of do the pilgrimage. And you know, like you have this like romantic like notion of being a writer, but still like, and then what happened was I kept a journal. I took a creative writing class. I wasn't very good. I thought I was solid, but I wasn't like, oh, this is it. And then my junior year, like there was like a fraternity at Occidental. I went to Occidental.
Yeah.
In Eagle Rock. And so there was a fraternity and they were called like ATO. And my freshman year,
one of my friends was an ATO.
Like the biggest douchebags ever.
Well, I don't know anything about fraternity life or sorority life. Like I was never part of that, but
where did you go?
I went to photo school. I'm an art nerd. He used to tell me that the other fraternities would diss ATO by saying, you can't spell faggot without ATO.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry that I just said that, but it always stuck in my memory as hilarious.
Yeah, the ATO. There was only like three frats at my school. There was like ATO, SAE, and like the Kappas.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like a black fraternity, so it wasn't
I'm surprised you didn't try to join the Kappas.
Yeah, I would have. You know what? I actually would think I would have had a better time in the Kappas. Like, I think we would have had a lot more eye to eye, whereas like ATO, like, it's all the base. ATO was basically baseball, all baseball and football
guys.
And it's interesting fraternities because I always think that like 1/3 of frat boys are actually decent, okay human beings, but they're very passive and very easily swayed.
Yeah.
So like there will be the dominant asshole douche personalities that care, that are like maybe only 20-25% of the fraternity, but those are end up being the leaders.
Yeah.
And then like the rest kind of just go along with. So you have decent guys, and I was sort of like in that 20% maybe that was like a decent guy, but like was in it. And then, but so I didn't know shit. You know, I was 17 when I was a freshman, like, you know, turned 18 as, you know, a couple months in.
Your initial major was going to be law, is that what you stuck with?
History, because it was liberal arts school, so it wasn't a business major.
Yeah, yeah.
And I loved history. That was like my favorite subject. And it was always really easy. And then more than English, I thought like maybe I'll be a historian or something. You know, I didn't know what that meant either. Like, you know, maybe I'll be a paleontologist. I don't know.
Yeah, right, right.
And I was like, you know, into dinosaurs like every kid, you know.
Oh, same, dude.
And, you know, like lost civilizations. I was like, maybe I'll find Atlantis, you know. And so I went in and like these guys were like such assholes, and like they went through the hazing and like, you know, all these like frat things, and I was like, what the, and like here I am, I'm like, the fuck is going on, like I can't deal. And so I ended up depledging a week before Hell Week. I came back from winter break and I was just like, I'd gone through a semester and all this drinking and shit and like playing, they had a game called Caps, they would drink. I remember the first time I knew I wasn't for it was like, my first weekend at the frat. I'd come hang out and like, they have like all these CDs in a wall, you know, they had like the CD, but kind of like,
and it was all the Eagles.
It was like fucking Social Distortion
and
shit.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I was like, yo, where's the rap? They're like, this guy likes rap. What the fuck? They're like, put on some Social D, boys. And I was like, oh my God. Like, I was like, they don't even have like the Chili Peppers. You know, they didn't even have like Blood Sugar Sex Magic, which think would be like the middle ground.
The quintessential white boy.
Yeah. They're like, we got this. It's like, suck my kiss, you know? And so I didn't even do that.
Well, so what about like depledging? What was that like?
Oh yeah, they didn't
was
like
big, not, big was, backlash.
Yeah, I had to, because yeah, they all hated me at that point. And then because I was, you know,
and a lot of them were still on the baseball team.
All on the baseball team.
Oh man, so the hazing on the baseball team must have increased.
Yeah, it wasn't.
Then.
I mean, I was starting as a freshman too, so it was like there was only so much you can talk shit when like this guy's good.
When you're
killing
it.
But like I wasn't like, you know what I mean? There were a lot of guys that gave me shit. They were, you know, they're all like car salesmen and shit now, and like insurance brokers and like third tier lawyers and, you know, ambulance chasers. But so then I did this whole thing, and it was just a weird thing, like, because I really saw like the mind control aspect of a fraternity and how like good people by the end of their time in the fraternity would kind of be corrupted.
Yeah,
they're corrupted, and they not all of them. I mean, there's some people, I'm sure there's plenty of great frat guys out there, but like a lot of them like turn out, you know, that you start being misogynistic, and like you start just, you know, they'd have like this one thing that really always offended me, and not because I'm like some kind of like I've never been one of those guys who's like I'm a feminist male.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
Just I am what I am. I believe what I believe, and I don't like to label it, but. Yeah, they had like a gavel, and you'd be like every week you'd be like you were supposed to talk about like what girl you fucked.
Oh my god!
So they'd be like, and you could pass the gavel, but they'd be like if one of your friends had heard that you'd hooked up, they would then out you. I mean, and like I would always like you know lie and say oh nothing because like you know, but yeah, they would talk. I mean, really nasty ass stories, and then you know,
yeah.
like double teaming girls.
It seems
and it
like
was
such
gross.
Weird overcompensation.
Like, it was weird. Yeah, it was yeah. like a really homoerotic place too. They'd be like, you know, I'd be like there. I was like 18. I'm like, where are the girls? You
yeah,
know,
yeah.
and like it'd be like, no girls. Us in the basement. Take off your shirts.
They're
and
like, no, it's time to be spanked.
Yeah, they'd be yeah. I'm like, why are there petals on the walls? Like there were like petals. I'm like, what the fuck is going on? I'm like, this is not what I signed up for. So I'm like, I'm out. Peace, guys.
Yeah.
You're wonderful human beings, but I'm out. They didn't like that.
Right.
Junior year comes around. Same thing. Like all these guys on my baseball team are now pledging the fraternity. I'm trying to be like, don't do it. This I promise you, this is not what you expect. And then there's like this big hazing trip. And they all go to Vegas during Hell Week, right? And I didn't do that, but I went everything but that. And then on the way home, a guy, one of my teammates, and, you know, they're on no sleep at all. A guy fell asleep, crashed the car.
Fuck.
One of my best friends is, like, has got brain damage. Like, it healed, but, like, not a hundred, like, 98%, you know?
Right,
and it's,
right.
like, he's, like, never been the same. And, like, there's another friend that, like, died. Like, one guy died. Our starting shortstop is 18 years old. He died. It was another guy, like the driver shattered his leg. Another guy was paralyzed for 6 months. I mean, it was like the most traumatic experience that had happened to any of us. You know, we're on the team and it's like, you know, it's that whole band of brothers thing. You know, like you're
really attached to your teammates.
Yeah. Like you're really attached to your teammates and we were going to be a good team. And like, it was like, it seemed like we'd had two really shitty teams and it seemed like this was going to be our year.
Yeah.
You know? And this kid dies, and like the week before, some guy had gone to Afghanistan. He was going to go to Afghanistan. He was joining the Marines, and then 9/11 had happened in the fall, and now he was going to like Afghanistan. And we're like, it was a really crazy, crazy time, and it just kind of, I just started writing after that. And then we had a team walkout.
So you started keeping the journal?
I'd already kind of had one, but I really started like, you know, writing like essays and poems and like,
yeah,
you know, like
yeah.
really bad poems.
Yeah.
And of course you think that they're amazing because you're like feeling this like onslaught of emotion, this like, you know,
yeah.
swelling, and you're like,
when you're 18 and you write a poem, you fucking feel
it. Like 20, but yeah, like
still,
you're still
at that time, it's like you feel like, oh man, I should show this to people.
Oh,
this
yeah, like my girlfriend at the time, and she's like, you're so good.
Yeah,
I was like,
yeah.
you know, I had a nice girlfriend at the time who like, I think we were young, so she probably liked it. But like now we're looking back, you'd be like, Jesus, that was awful.
Right, exactly.
But yeah, no, I started, I was really upset and I started writing a novel like when the year was over that summer. And it was originally gonna be a short story because I knew I had creative writing in the fall and I was gonna take it a second time. And I was interested, but I never thought I'd do it for a living. And then I started writing this short story, which was like, then it became a 40-page short story. And then it became a 115-page novella. And then it ended up becoming a novel. So then I was basically working on this novel whenever I had free time.
No shit.
For years. Yeah. And then I finished it ultimately. Like, I graduated and then I was like, what the fuck am I gonna do after I write this novel?
Did you stay majoring in history the whole time?
Yeah. I took a minor in English.
Oh,
I took
okay.
a bunch of classes my senior year.
Yeah.
And then I really, by that point I was like, okay, you're gonna be a writer. You're gonna do this. I don't know how. And then I was convinced I'm gonna be a novelist. And then you graduate and you're like, no one's paying.
Pick up on the novel or what?
You know, it took me like a million drafts and like 3 years after I graduated. So I was like, I think 24, I was about to turn 25 and I finished it. And then I got this like agent, like this like TV, or is a TV manager. And then I got a TV agent and they're like, we want you to write. I just started Passion of the Weiss. Like I was working as a business reporter, started Passion of the Weiss. They like Passion of the Weiss. They hadn't seen the book, but I was like, I'm about to finish this book. They're like, cool. You have a young voice. Let's have you write a TV pilot. So I write a TV pilot and they're like, don't worry. When you sell this pilot, you're going to sell your book too. And you're going to be like, this great. You know what I mean? Like, so of course, like I write the book, I write the pilot. It takes me like 6 months to spend all this time working on this pilot.
Was it a drama or a comedy?
It was like a comedy. It was like stupid. It was gonna be called The Young and the Rested.
Okay.
And it was like a satire of young, like rich LA kids like living at the Palazzo, you know, the Palazzo.
I do, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's like it was just so absurd. Like, and I was dating a girl at the time who like her mom used to like work there, and it just was like such a jaded, like, you know, ridiculous. I wrote this whole thing and it was just a pure Zoolander. I was a really into, like, Zoolander. It was like, my favorite movie.
Right, right.
Still is one of my favorite movies. And So I started writing this.
I would not have guessed that.
Really?
No, I thought you'd be like, oh, I'm into Apocalypse Now.
No,
something.
I like dumb shit.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, like, I like dumb. I like, you know, like, yeah, I could feel like it's boring to be like, oh, I like Fellini.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Oh, have you seen La Dolce Vita?
Right,
eight
right.
And a half. You know, I can't, you know, it's, yeah, I've seen that shit. I like it, but it's like, you know.
You're into the absurd.
Yeah, I like Woody. I didn't get exposed to Woody. I finally got exposed to Woody Allen. I was like, oh my God.
Yeah, yeah.
All these things that I've wanted to, you know.
Right.
And
so what happens with the pilot?
It's just like they were like, it needs 8 more drafts. And I was like, okay. And then I just like didn't care. And then like the book, I was like 6 months out of the book. And I was like, I'm not I just, you know, you have to be able to sell it. Like, have you ever like finished a piece of music and you're just like, oh, I can't sell. Like, you're just like, I don't have it in me to be
every
like
every song I've ever made.
Right. Like, I don't have it in me to like do this.
Well, there's a big difference, and there's also a balancing act between a creative side and a business side, and some people have both, and those are the people that end up playing stadium shows. And
totally.
Then there's some people that only have one, and those are the people that end up being, you know,
totally
that just do the creative shit and that's it.
Yeah, well, it's like, you don't, I mean, and there's also like not like and there are indie, but like I didn't know anyone to give it to. It was, and then I like realized it's a young adult novel because I started writing when I was 20.
Yeah,
so it's like about 18-year-olds, so it's a young adult novel, like no matter how you slice
it's Twilight.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, basically. I should add more vampires.
Yeah, yeah.
He's a baseball player. Who's a vampire?
Yeah. I feel like Frankenstein is the next big monster to blow up, so you just throw a Frankenstein in it and resell it.
Yeah, know? Like some kind of, like, it.
So what inspired you to start Passion of the Weiss?
I thought I read all these like blogs on the internet, and I thought they were kind of cool. Like, there were a couple ones I thought
what
were cool.
What year was this?
Like, end of 05.
Oh, end of 05.
I was reading all these music blogs. Like, I liked Gorilla vs. Bear. I liked Aquarium Drunkard. Like, I kind of had like a little bit of an indie.
I feel like 05 is still pretty early to jump on the blog train, too.
Yeah.
Like, it's not early adopter, but it's like the second stage of early adopter. Feel me?
Totally. Yeah. I mean, it's a good thing and a bad thing because like, you get in first, but at the same time, like the business model, like I kept my same model, you know, which was like writing things.
Yeah, I've always
which is not good for.
That was one of the only things that I had planned to ask you was kind of like, what made you choose to do think pieces on Passion of the Weiss rather than like go with the constant updates and the like.
Well, that's how blogs were at the time. You know, it used to be like you'd write one thing a day, and it was like and also like at the time there, I found like, you know, you remember like 05, it was like every Southern shit was like, I liked Southern rap. I always liked Southern rap, you know, like Outkast was my favorite, Goody Mob. I was Cool Breeze, Witch Doctor. I loved that shit.
Yeah.
Loved Dungeon Family. But like Southern rap is cool too. But like it was the over intellectualization of like kind of shit that was pretty, you know, just party music, like, and that's cool, but it was just the way that it was written about in like such an erudite way, like such a faux erudite way, I should say. And it kind of just was like, and then like you're like, it was like not like I was a Little Brother fan, but they're like, oh, Little Brother's the most boring bullshit thing ever, and I'm like, you know what, like neither of these things maybe are like the greatest thing ever,
right?
Like, you know, and it was just not a good time for hip-hop in general, I'd say 2005, like,
yeah,
2006.
It was a rough time.
Just not that much. Like, you look back, you're like, yeah, I guess I like
it. Was kind of the end of
documentary was good. Doctor's Advocate was, but like, was it really?
That era was kind of the end of the glory years of the backpacker rap.
Totally. Yeah, because the backpack shit, like, you know, I grew up on like hardcore, like gangster rap and shit.
Yeah.
And then
it was
like
the people that had kind of blown up during the alt stage.
Totally.
Were like kind of pushing their underlings because they had some.
Like, how bad Quali was terrible by that point. Most stuff was like, God knows. And Doom was cool, but like, Doom's like Doom.
So who were you writing about then?
I don't know, a lot of dumb shit probably. I was probably like a Fish Scale I was really into.
Oh, Fish Scale. Yeah.
Fish Scale was dope.
Yeah, that
I'm
that's
not proud
thing,
of anything I
that's
wrote.
One thing that was going on in the 05, 06
was
like
crack rap.
Was
the coke
Ghostface
rap.
Was in a renaissance phase, and also Dipset was like killing it.
Yeah, I never really got exposed. I liked Dipset, but I still like them. I don't like, I never had like the love of Dipset.
That's so funny. I had Fantano on, and he said he was saying kind of the same thing where it's like he was aware of the records but never got into them, which is crazy because in the forums at the time,
totally.
I wasn't a blog reader, but I was a forum dude. They were huge on the forums.
Yeah, see, you were on the Philly Flavor.
Like on Philly Flavor.
You see, I never was on Philly Flavor.
A little bit Soul like Strut. UndergroundHipHop.com.
Yeah, I didn't
like,
know about those. I never was really an internet person. Like, I've never been, it's so weird because I'm kind of at heart, probably, I'm like kind of an anti-internet person, I think, who makes a living on the internet.
Yeah.
But I do it, you know, but do I like that? Do I like Twitter? Like, no.
Yeah.
I mean, it's fun, but like, it's kind of, it's poisonous in its own way.
Right.
You know, it's because it's like ultimately like the Louis C.K. thing. You know, it's, you remember when you said, did you see the Louis C.K. thing where he's like talking about how he's going to text somebody and like, you know, you're having this moment alone and like,
yeah.
Then, you know, you get lonely and you kind of
– yeah.
He's right, in my opinion, even though, like, yes, you could be like, okay, shut up, like, baby boomer with your, like, anti. But, like, there is something to be said, like, where your brain, you're listening to something and then, like, oh, like, you have this moment. But then, oh, no, I'm going to interrupt it and a text or I'm a tweet it.
Yeah.
And then – but your brain doesn't have the same flow. I feel my brain, like, fracturing into a million ways. And, like, the internet, it's like I sit down to write. And, oh, you have 80 emails that you have to respond to a million editors. And you're getting – someone's tweeting at you. And then you have a Facebook like and you're like, who likes it? Who likes it? And then you look back and you're like, man, like, what did I just do, you know? And I think that's kind of –
The insurgence of the internet accessibility being so easy with a phone next to you has really affected – I know it's affected my creativity a shitload because I can't even separate myself. Like, I used to take myself out of my house to write and listen to music and write and stuff. And it's now even in my car I can find myself going like, okay, well, I'm stuck on this bar. Let me check Instagram real quick.
I wrote my book like left hand – like longhand with a fucking flip phone, you know? And like there was no way to get to me. And you know what? Like I'm hoping that one – I mean the goal I think is one day – like I think that's how you know when you're – there was a famous like Bob Dylan quote where he was like, you know you're a success when you wake up in the morning and go to sleep at night and you do everything you want to do. Now I'm like, you kind of know you're a success when you can not have any contact with the outside world and it doesn't matter because like people are – like Mad Lib. Like I think Mad Lib is amazing because people are always trying to get to him. So it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Because Mad Lib just knows that people are going to try to get to him. So he doesn't have to – he can respond whatever the fuck Mad Lib wants because if Mad Lib responds to you, then like – and that's like – I'm not to say – not to compare myself to Mad Lib because that's absurd. But like that's – I just think the cool – I think that's cool, you know? And like I'd love to like be like a writer at that level where you're just like, yeah, like I check my email every 5 days.
Right.
You know, and I like check my Twitter every 5 days.
Yeah, I've always – in a similar note, I've always heard that like you know you're starting to be successful when you can say no to things.
Totally.
Like when it doesn't matter to say no because when you first start, you have to say yes to
everything.
Oh,
yeah.
You know what I mean? And when you can start saying no is when you have some power in your hands. So after the pilot and after you finish your
– I started writing a screenplay. Novel. I started writing a screenplay about boy bands called Heat Wave.
And that was like
– which I still think is like by far the best thing I've ever done. Any story, anything.
Is it an absurdist comedy?
It's like Zoolander with boy bands.
Yeah,
and set in 1999. It's like a period. Piece.
Oh,
and
that would
like,
be perfect as retro right now.
Totally. Set in 1999. Like, they have – it's Heat Wave, and like, it's basically the lead singer's name is Ocean, and he thinks he's like John Lennon.
Yeah.
He takes like – they take psychedelic drugs. He thinks he's like John Lennon, but he's really more like Justin Timberlake.
Yeah.
And mixed with Jim Morrison. You know, like.
Yeah, yeah. I was just looking at a picture yesterday of Justin Timberlake and Britney Spears when they went to like the Grammys or something in full denim outfits.
Frosted tips.
No, like, she had on a denim dress, and he had on a denim tuxedo and a denim cowboy hat. It was like the most 90s picture I've ever fucking seen.
I mean, it's funny because people come to my house and they're like, why do you have a Backstreet Boys DVD? I'm like, I swear it was research. And they're like, yeah, right.
So when did you start picking up journalist gigs then?
Well, I quit my business journal job in 2005. Mm-hmm. And it was like under the thing where I was like, look, like I had money saved up and I was like, okay, you have enough money to maybe last you a year if you live like really cheap, like maybe 8 months. Mm-hmm. I knew I could pick up side gigs, you know, tutoring gig, whatever the fuck, you know, any kind of like spare job, you know, jobs will pop up and you'll just do them. Mm-hmm. I was like, I bet I can, because people started like, you know, a couple hundred hits a day. So I thought that was pretty cool. And like, I was like, I bet I can get enough writing gigs. You know, I've never been like, the kind of person that like buys himself stuff. I'm not really into like,
right.
I don't like need like the illest new clothes. You know what I mean? Like I'm not, who cares? Like it's not, I mean, you want to look nice, but like I'm not going to buy
it. You're talking to a guy sitting here in sweatpants. You don't gotta tell me.
Yeah. You know, I just like finally I'm like, oh, maybe you should not wear white socks. Like I'm like, you know, it was like my new, all right. Yeah. And then like, so I was like, I bet I can get enough jobs so I won't have to go back to a day job. And like that, I didn't, you know, that was it. And I started writing for the LA Times and the Weekly and, you know, and then one thing led to another. And like, I get a lot of emails about like, I've been lucky. I don't really have to pitch very much, which is cool, you know, because I'm not really very good at that. And, you know, it's, I just don't like selling something to people. I don't really like, have that salesman mentality.
Right. How long was it before people like Rolling Stone started reaching out?
A couple years.
Yeah.
A couple years. I mean, it like really 2010 maybe.
Yeah.
Because you kind of have to be a local writer first, prove yourself. And, you know, I worked really hard. Like, I, like, you know, it would be like a story, you know, where you're getting like $600 or something. But I would, like, interview somebody 4 times and, like, you know, go follow them for weeks, you know. Yeah. And, like I mean, I did this Jerkin story. Like, that was, like, the first one where I was, like, I was really inspired. And then I really – so this is when I started to really, like you know, I kind of graduated to, like, really take it – you know, once I – when I made the decision, like, as a senior in college to be, like, a writer, I started taking it really seriously. I was, like, all right, if you're going to do it – because the last thing no one needs is a mediocre writer.
So you did a story on jerking and just took it, like, super seriously?
I mean, a bunch of things. But, like, yeah, like, I was really reading a lot of Tom Wolfe at the time. And I'd been a big Hunter Thompson fan. And all the new Joan Didion and, like, Truman Capote. Capote and like was really into that, you know, Gay Talese. And so I started reading, I was like, all right, well, this is a story. This is a phenomenon. You should just post up and interview everybody and go down for a month and just embed yourself. And I don't really do that as much anymore because there's not, you know, that's, it was kind of a special story.
Yeah,
I felt.
Yeah.
It was a moment, you know.
It was.
I kind of felt like the story didn't come out. The story came out more like in the edits, like the editor at the time was kind of like, you know, new cool thing. And like, I was more like, this is probably going to be a
flash in the pan type.
Yeah. And I didn't know how long. It could be like a year flash in the pan. It could be like a 3 month flash. It was more like,
there was a lot of flash in the pans around that time.
Totally. Like Soulja Boy was a real flash in the pan, even though he's had a career, but you know.
Well, it was like it was like hyphy, then jerking, then this,
and
the
wet chicken noodle soup in New York was kind of a big thing for a while, and then like hyphy. It was just, it seemed like that was, they were looking for the next thing, and then so then it was just stuff like that, and I feel like that, I don't know, I feel like a lot of people just want to sit in their house and be critics. I don't like criticism, honestly. Like I'll do it, it's fine. Like it's something to do. You know, if someone offers, you know, if someone's like reviewing,
you enjoy telling the story more than giving the opinion.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I like profiles. What I want to do right now is I love doing the Lakers stuff, but I was just in New York pitching a story that nobody really wanted to pay me to go for. But, you know, in Greece, there was a murder of anti-fascist rapper, and a lot of people don't know, but there was this party called the Golden Dawn, all the austerity thing. Greece is like really fucked up right now, if you don't know. Like, you know, they had all this austerity plan to cut back, like very high unemployment, tons of strikes and protests. And so this neo-Nazi party.
Because they like pulled out from the Euro or some shit like that?
I don't know. I don't think they pulled out from the Euro, but I think the Euro really, really fucked them up. Because, they were a country that was not like, Germany is very well equipped to be on the Euro, but Greece is not, you know, like Italy was not, you know, like certain countries, the dollar, you know, it's, and anyways, but.
No, so you wanted to go out there and do a profile on this rapper that got murdered?
That murdered by neo-Nazi party, the Golden Dawn, and they had 19 members in the parliament, and all the members of the parliament got arrested, and there was a conspiracy, and I wanted to go out there, and, you know, because I wrote the book on Tupac and like in Biggie thing with Evan McGarvey, and I wrote that Boosie story in 2012.
Right.
And so, you know, I really wanted someone to go out there, and I really wanted to do like, you know, it'd be probably dangerous. You know, it's not like, then the guy got, you know, no one's like, oh, you know, a Jewish guy covering Greek neo-Nazis. It's like, not like, you know, but I feel I'm not really a war reporter. So this was probably the most, and I wanted to do that. That's the kind of stuff that I'd like to do, I think, more. And
but nobody wanted to pick it up?
People were interested, but nobody wanted to, you know.
Do you think maybe you'll fund it yourself and just try to make the money back after, or no?
I did that with the Boosie thing, and I'm kind of not that interested in just – like, I kind of find, like, a big void in journalism. It's not any editor's fault. It's not any – it's just there's not that much money anymore in it, and the ads aren't there, and the online ads haven't recovered to take over the print ones.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask about, too, is kind of like – with the onset of so many blogs and journalism kind of going the way of the buffalo, like traditional journalism, it's a rarity to find a site like Passion of the Vice where when you choose a song to write about, there's actually a think piece about it.
I don't know about a think piece, but at least thought.
At least a thought.
And like, that's the thing. Like,
what I mean is you pick and choose your things that you want to talk about, and you actually talk about them and analyze them slightly. Yeah. Whereas most people are just copy pasting the press
release.
Totally.
And that's the thing. And like, you know, and like, it's frustrating and good in a way because like if like I always said like there's a lot of stuff like I like that I don't write about, and like maybe I don't love it, but like I only write about the stuff that I like really I'm like, you know what I mean, like, and that's very, very not, it's just not that much, and like it, that's okay because I feel like it counts, but at the same time it's the worst business model in the world because you'll never get the clicks, and like like we were talking about Macklemore before, like I don't fuck with Macklemore, like I don't even like, you know, like there's some shit like I'll be like, all right, that's cool, like, you know, I'm okay with that, like, you know, and but I won't, it doesn't move me enough to write about it maybe, but like if I wrote about Macklemore, if I wrote about Drake, if I wrote about like the new Rick Ross single, if I wrote about the new Lil Wayne single, that shit's Eminem, like we didn't even have an Eminem review because no one pitched it to me, and like I wasn't about to write, like I wrote like one thing randomly when I kind of liked the Berserk video, I didn't love it, but I was like kind of interested me, and I was a big Eminem fan at one point.
Yeah, same.
But see,
I haven't been able to listen to him since Marshall Mathers LP.
Yeah, honestly, I liked the Eminem show at the time, but I couldn't listen to it today. Yeah. He had a very brief
to be honest, I was such genius. A backpacker at the time that even the Marshall Mathers LP, I was like, oh, he is already really? he's already falling off. This is the beginning of the end.
Yeah, I never really got that into the politics of the backpacker thing, but like I was really into Def Jux and Ruckus for a while.
No, so I get going back before we go off too far on a tangent. I guess my question is like with the democratization of journalism, and I feel like now. Somewhat the power of popularity is in the people's hands. That was a lot of alliteration. But like I think the internet picks and chooses what they want to listen to now.
Yeah.
Whereas in the past, maybe a lot of the power was in music journalism's
way
hands.
More.
How does journalism survive in this era?
Well, I mean, I think you've seen like the way it does, and it's maybe not pretty. You know, it's like lists and like covering everything and 75 posts a day. And it sucks because like what do you – that's why I liked the early days of blogging was cool because it's like whether you like someone or didn't like someone, they were thinking about it and they were only really like – they were trying to dig up obscure shit or there was stuff that they were like really obsessed with at the time or they really hated at the time. But they at least were thinking. Now it's like, you know, Tumblr's cool. Like, you know, people – kids can write their things on Tumblr and – but you don't see that many like – blogs that start up. I see like kids, you know, they'll start a Tumblr and it just goes by the wayside. And most of the blogs that I came up with are the same. I don't know. I felt like there was a void. I felt like there was not stuff being – you know, and like it is a rigged game.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you don't – if you have the right publicist, if you have the right – you know, you can't force everything, but like it's still a rigged game to some extent. You know, the right cosign or it's – but you know, I think cosigns are more like artists. Like I was saying, like I think we're going to have Isaiah Rashad on Shots Fired next week. We wrote about him like a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote to me. I forwarded it to one of my writers. I was like, this is good. Check it out. Let me know what you think about it. He liked it. He wrote about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. No one had written about it. Maybe Smoking. I think Smoking Section had written about Isaiah Rashad. I think that was about it.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody like commented like DJ Booth. I'm like, okay, whatever. Cool. Like, I don't think anyone's reading DJ Booth. I mean, it's a valuable resource, but no one's like, did you see the review on DJ? You know, anyways,
not
to diss them. I don't really know them. I'm sure they're great guys. But now like you look up Isaiah Rashad, right? He's fucking everywhere.
After the BET cipher, I mean, he really stood out.
But it's because he has the TDE cosign. And like, I still feel the artist, like the writer cosign, people like make a big deal about it. It's not what it is. It's like, you know, it's a very, very, very slow trickle. 1-1-1-1-1 maybe. But once you get an artist cosign, like a TDE, like all of a sudden, they're everywhere. And it's like that's what really is depressing to me about journalism. I mean, it's nothing to lament. I mean, it's always been like that. It's always going to be like that. People are, you know, but it is frustrating that it has to be like, and I get it. Like I am friends with a lot of these editors, the people that, you know, friendly at least with people that run big publications. And a lot of them are really smart, hardworking people.
Yeah.
And they're kind of trapped in a system that unless you're Pitchfork, which is the one place that seems to be able to get away with that.
Uh-huh.
And like, I, you know, people shit on Pitchfork all the time. I have a lot of respect for them and I do write for them. So I am biased, but I have a lot of respect for them in the sense that like, say what you want about them. They don't do stupid lists all the time.
Yeah.
They don't have like if they do a list, it's for the sake of doing a list, not for the sake of just okay, we need to do a list right now.
Yeah.
They review records still. They give thought to it. Those are really thoughtful reviews. I mean, you might think the writing is terrible on a given review.
I mean, I'm down with the writing.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah. I mean, like, you know, everyone's open to their own opinion. I mean, some every publication. If you go to Passion Lewis, some reviews are good.
Yeah.
Some reviews are not as good.
Right.
That's just how it is. But they at least are, you know, they've been able to get away with it. They can do like long form reviews and people still care. And I wish that there were five places like Pitchfork because I think we'd be a lot better for it. Unfortunately, I don't know if there is the level of interest. I mean, music has become a niche thing. I was talking about it earlier with a friend where it's like, now I'm writing about sports, right? And if you think about sports, the media is at every step of the way. You're watching a game. You can't watch without the media. There's the halftime show. There's the announcers at the game. There's the sideline reporters. There's the newspaper the next day. There's the online stories that are proliferating immediately.
Mm-hmm.
There's the Twitter personalities that everyone's following on sports. If you think about music, it's a covenant between the artist and the listener usually. It's like, I'm alone. I'm listening to this shit. Like, there's no media involved.
And it means something to me that it might not mean to somebody else.
Completely. And that's what's beautiful about music, but it's also like what makes it maybe not that viable as a career option.
Right.
And I mean, I've been lucky to I mean, it's like I like writing about music. I mean, it's like someone called me it's funny. Some kid wrote to me the other day and he meant well. He was like in college and I was a total asshole about it. And like I was like a really.
I think it's good to be assholes to people behind the scenes to like.
It'll be valuable for him in the future.
That's how I look at it.
Totally.
When people approach me wrong, every once in a while, this is a side note, but every once in a while, someone will approach me wrong on Facebook asking for advice or telling me to listen to something and they'll say some stupid shit.
Yeah.
And I'll be like, look, man, I'm going to sound like an asshole right now, yeah, but 5 years from now, you're going to understand why I did this and thank me for it. But like, you shouldn't do this and you shouldn't talk to people this way. And you and like, da 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 da.
What was really smart of yours was your music too early thing. That was really smart.
I appreciate it. But sometimes people fucking come back at me and be like, you're a fucking dick. I thought you were humble. And I'm like, yo, bro, I'm taking time out of my fucking day to write back to you. And give you advice, and even though it's not the advice that you want to hear, it's better advice than like, how can I get better
at rapping? Totally, like, you know, you might not be like Macklemore, I might not be fucking Chuck Klosterman, but at the same time, like, you're busy, I'm busy, you know what I mean? Like, it's like, people have shit to do, and like, so this kid wrote to me, and he was like asking, he's like, as a white hip-hop critic, and I'm like, those are the most offensive things you could have said. Yeah. I was like, first of all, what is, like, oh yeah, I'm white, but like, come on, like, don't come. And like, then I was like, I'm not really a hip hop critic, and I'm like, I'm not even a critic. I do criticism sometimes. I love hip hop, and I am a white person.
I'm a journalist.
I'm just like a writer. You know, it's just like, I mean,
I'm an entity.
Yeah, I'm a brand. Yo, that's what I can't stand is these kids on Twitter being like, ah, personal brand, and like, I'm like, I know you're tongue in cheek ironic, but you're not really ironic.
Right.
You really are caring about your brand, and like, fuck your brand. Fuck that shit. Be yourself. If you are yourself, you will be your brand.
Yeah.
That's like one thing I will say about Kanye. He's crazy, but there's no fucking filter.
Right.
He's not really crazy. You know, he's crazy like a fox, Kanye.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, but like, I can't believe we've gone this long without talking about Kanye, thankfully. It's like,
where can the people find you online?
They can find, I mean, I'm on Twitter. Like,
you're on Twitter, at
Passion Weiss. PassionWeiss.com. We have the Shots Fired podcast with me and No Can Do.
Yep.
Which we just relaunched, which is cool. I have a book called...
Why'd you guys take a hiatus? What happened?
Like, we basically are switching from Earwolf to the loudspeakers now work with Combat Jack.
Oh, yeah, tight.
And so, yeah, it just, you know, and now we're kind of like, we got to figure it out ourselves. And we were like, fuck it, let's take a break and kind of like regroup and figure out how we're going to... You were recording here in the Cosmic Zoo.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a different energy. You kind of have to like...
Yeah, I know. I'm scared. I'm going to have to, like, when I schedule, I'm going to have to like hit you guys up first to make sure you guys aren't in here at the same time.
Next Thursday.
Oh, okay.
But, yeah.
How has the experience of podcasting been for you?
It's weird. It's like everything else. It's like, you know, I feel like I've been doing these things that I maybe not like I was not an internet person. You know what I mean? Like I was never like on, like I said, like I was never on message boards. I like read Pitchfork a little bit. Like, but I wasn't like in my own head, I'm an offline person. In reality, I'm a very online person.
Were you ever a talk radio dude?
No,
yeah.
No, I was always like music. And like, I'd never listened to a podcast. When we did the thing on Earwolf, when we were like, they're like, yeah, we'll pick you up, I had not listened to one Earwolf podcast ever.
Yeah. Well,
never.
That's the funny thing about the...
I still have only listened to one Earwolf. I listened to like one episode of Comedy Bang Bang once. Yo, Is This Racist? I was on, and I love Andrew T, but like, I don't listen to podcasts.
Right. When I first started doing the podcast, I barely even really knew what one was and was terrible. And then as time went on, I started listening to more. And now I'm actually kind of like a podcast nerd, but I only have like five that I listen to.
What do you listen to?
All right, I'll shout out all these guys. Well, I listen to Oh Yeah Dude. I find those two guys hilarious. John Larroquette is in it, who's also in Jogger.
Yeah.
Low End Theory shit.
Yeah.
I listen to Combat Jack. Yeah. I fuck with that.
Yeah, Combat Jack is they do an amazing.
They're great.
Job.
I really think like Dallas Penn is hilarious.
Yeah, Dallas is one of the early blogs I read. Yeah, Reggie too. Like when he would do stuff on ByronCrawford.com. I've been reading Reggie forever. So yeah, we're gonna be on Loudspeakers Network. Is Combat Jack?
Yeah, Combat Jack. If you're listening, holler at your boy because I need money too. Oh, actually, I also like the Italian. What's the Italian dude on Combat Jack?
Premium Pete.
Yeah,
Premium he's Pete. Funny.
Fucking,
I like him because he's just like he's like reminds me of like my New York side of the family.
Yeah,
he's just like so raw.
Yeah, dude. Premium Pete is hilarious. So anyway, Combat Jack show's tight. I listened to the Crab Feast, which is kind of like these two comedians. I have a comedian on every week just telling stories, and it's really funny. And then I listened to. Marin, whenever there's a good guest.
Comedians are so good. Like we had Eric Andre on Shots Fired, and he was like a magician. I was like, oh my god, you're so not funny.
Right.
You know, like I was like, eh, you're not that funny. That's funny.
Yeah,
you know? So,
but yeah, I totally just ripped off my whole format from Marin, and I'm unabashed about that, and have no qualms about it. So it's fine.
Yeah, I still haven't listened. I meant to listen to Mike's Open Mike Eagles episode on that, but
I had Mike on the show and I said publicly that I thought it was kind of an uncomfortable one. When you listen to enough Marin podcasts, you can see the guys who he's really comfortable with and the ones that kind of make him leave his element and his realm.
Yeah.
And Mike, being an independent hip hop dude,
totally.
Was very. I don't think he could really wrap his brain around it, so the interview was awkward. So your Twitter, passionoftheweiss.com.
Yeah, and then I'm covering the Lakers, so like, I mean, that's at LA Weekly, but you can find all that on Twitter and like Facebook. If people want to add me is like, just, I don't care. I'm not like, yeah. And then, well, yeah, Passion Lights is getting redesigned too. So we're relaunching that hopefully at the beginning of the year. So
tight, man.
Should look good. And
what was the shout out the Biggie book that you guys
wrote? Yeah. I have a book out called Biggie and Tupac, Rap's Greatest Battle. And it's me and Evan McGarvey wrote it. And
why did you guys choose to do that?
You know, honestly, the editor hit us up and they're like, are you interested? And I was like, yeah, because everyone says stupid things about Biggie and Tupac.
Are you more of a Tupac guy than a Biggie guy?
I feel Tupac now a lot more than I did when I first was. Oh, I was really into Tupac at first. I was really into both of them.
Yeah.
And then I was really obsessed with Biggie. And like, I was really more of a Biggie person. I think if you're a writer, you're by default more of a Biggie person. You kind of have to be. But I admire like Tupac's savagery and like his like rawness and his unfiltered aspect of it. And just like that energy that he brought and the emotion and the ability that he could cut through to. I mean, because that's really the goal, I think, is to be able to like communicate to the most people without watering down your message and without watering down your, and he was amazing at that. He's so gifted at it.
Absolutely. And I think that's what you try to do in your everyday life, and you just set me up with the perfect fucking ending because you're communicating in an unfiltered way to the masses via Passion of the Weiss and via Shots Fired Podcast.
And, you know, my shirtless leather kind of phase, like dressing up like Tupac.
Yeah,
so.
I wish you would put your shirt on right now. I wish you would put it back on.
I've been shirtless the entire
–
the whole interview. It's weird. Yeah.
So,
here.
Jeff, thanks for coming in,
thanks,
man.
Thanks for having me, man.
Yeah, I appreciate it. My name is Lee. Some of you guys might know me as Intuition. You can follow me on Twitter at It's Intuition. You can follow my man, Ben Shin, behind the boards, making the shit sound buttery, at I Am Database. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/kindaneat, youtube.com/thatskindaneat, and everything wrapped in a pretty package at kindaneat.net. That is very long and gets awkward when you have to sit there and watch it.
Pretty seamless, though.
Yeah, thanks. I practice. I do.
It's not rapping.
Yeah. I mean, this is, I think, you're our 44th episode already, so it's going,
that
fast.
That was my favorite number when I was a kid because Eric Davis, he's
really
44.
I was 21 because of Roberto Clemente.
Really? I was an obsessive Eric Davis fan.
Anyways, that's us bullshitting, and that was kind of neat. Thanks, man.